Hello, and welcome to Object Matters. My name's Craig Barker. I'm the head of public engagement at the Chow Chak Wing Museum at the University of Sydney. Object Matters is a podcast that explores a guest's relationship with one of the objects in the collection. And for this particular episode, I'm really, really excited to be joined by author and historian Dr. Kira Lindsay. Kira is South Australia's history advocate, working for the History Trust of South Australia, and has just published a brand new book, which we'll be talking about today. But thank you so much for joining us on Object Matters, Kira.
Oh, thanks, Craig. Thanks for inviting me.
Now, let's begin. Can I ask you to talk a bit about your career and your research interests?
Yeah, sure. So, look, I did a PhD at the University of Melbourne in history, and in that I did a lot of research around the story of my great-great-great-aunt, who was Mary Ann Gill, and she was just on her 16th birthday when she shimmied down the drainpipe of her father's three-story hotel in Sydney in 1848 and to attempt to elope with the Attorney General's wayward second son, a man named James Butler Kinchella. So that story totally gripped me with all sorts of things, particularly how you write the colonial era in a way that is based in a bedrock of solid archival research, as Penny Russell, who's a professor of history here at UCID, once said, and but how you do it in a way that is based in historical research, but also can engage and connect with general readers so that they can share our joy and fascination and pleasure for the colonial era. So I did that PhD. That turned into my first book, which was published with Allen and Unwin, and it did all right. And out of that, I got an Australian Research Council grant to work on a project called Speculative Biography.
Yes, I'm going to come back and talk to you about this.
Yeah, beauty. So Speculative Biography, Historical Craft, and the Case of Adelaide Ironside. And so that's what I did for 6 years or so. I was based at UTS at the Australian Centre for Public History. And in that process, I was doing a lot of kind of thinking about what are the theological and ethical challenges of informing our imaginations when we try and write the lives of people who are pretty much underrepresented in the archives.
Yes.
So my particular interest is a group of 19th century women who were known as currency lasses. They were the first European women to be born in the colonies of Australia. And I thought they had a really distinctive set of characteristics, but there was so little about them, Craig, either in the archives and certainly in scholarship. There was a little bit of work.
Yes.
So I thought, well, I'm going to make this a mission of mine. Yeah. And fortunately, Mary Ann Gill, the person I wrote about, my great-great-great-aunt, she was one of those women. And so her story was a terrific story. There was a lot of newspapers around her case because it was a colonial scandal, a romantic scandal.
Yes.
And there was this glorious deposition in the State Records of New South Wales, which even had her signature blotched with what I'm sure were tears that she cried as she was being forced by her father to give evidence against the man that she wanted to marry.
Yeah.
But what I couldn't find from that story was any information about how currency lasses, so first generation European born women, how they felt about their country and their politics.
Yeah.
And that's a massive contrast to what we find with currency lads. There's a pretty healthy archive there about these blokes. And what is kind of really intrigued me was a lot of them talk about how these fellas are always toasting themselves and their country and punctuating these toasts with expletives like bloody. So we can imagine them going, the land, boys, we bloody live in. Isn't it bloody marvellous? And so I was like, okay, that's pretty intriguing. Like, who knew that there was such a spirit of colonial patriotism in the 1820s and 30s, et cetera, et cetera. And the way that they were speaking, the way that they were positioning themselves in oppositions to the group they called the Jimmigrants, the migrants that had just arrived, and the way that they position themselves very ambiguously with First Nations people.
Yes.
Sometimes using the word native born.
I was going to say the native born sons of New South Wales.
That's
seems
right.
Such an oxymoron from a 21st century lens, but it must have made perfect sense to them that they were born in the colony, they were men of the colony.
That's exactly right. And that's how they saw it. So they would often grow up with First Nations people and have quite intimate, you know, close friendships with them, learn bushcraft from them. One of the classic cases is Hamilton Hume, whom I did my master's on. But they were also usurping the land, using those bush skills to do that and to assert themselves as the people who had, and this is the interesting phrase they use, the priority. Yeah. To claim the land. They had the first priority over the Jimmigrants and the migrant groups, the Stirling classes coming in, and over First Nations people. So I felt that there was a kind of darker heart at early colonial patriotism that needed some investigation because it still has its seeds in contemporary Australian nationalism. But my question was, well, what did the women think?
Yeah.
I couldn't find anything about that in the story of Mary Ann Gill, cracking as it is as a kind of colonial romance.
Yes.
So I started to think about how might I find this? Where would I go? And I remembered coming across this curious creature called Adelaide Ironside early on in my research about currency lasses. And I thought, look, I'll just go and find out about her. And lo and behold, she has an abundance of riches when it comes to archival sources in comparison to other 19th century Australian-born European women of that particular time. She has letters in the State Library, in the Society of Genealogy. Yeah. She has artwork, you know, everything from really loose sketches through to more large oil paintings, which I think we're going to talk about. And she also has more than 20 poems, which she published in the People's Advocate, which was the most radical colonial newspaper in the period. And lo and behold, when you look at those poems in particular, then you find that she was almost feverish and mystical in her zeal, in her patriotic zeal for the country. In fact, she explicitly describes herself as wanting to become the mistress of art in the Southern Hemisphere. That's why she wants to go abroad, so that she can elevate her sex and hoist the colours of her dear old country abroad. So now we get to go into that darker heart of colonial patriotism through the story of her life. Yeah.
All right, we're going to come back to Adelaide in a moment. But before I even ask about your writing process and your research process, professionally, so you've worked with a whole lot of historical organisations and institutions as well as your academic career. Where are some of the places you've been working?
I got my PhD from Melbourne University, and then I was very lucky to get a lectureship in Australian history at the University of South Australia, and I worked there in the David Yunaipon Centre for Indigenous Education and Research, which was really such an exciting opportunity to kind of think about Australian history through the lens of how my First Nation colleagues felt about it, which was pretty different from, I think, how we were often engaging with Australian history at the time.
Yeah.
You know, so it brought in these bigger questions, and I was really lucky to meet my husband while I was working there. And then I got this ARC, so I moved from the University of South Australia to University of Technology Sydney, working in the Australian Centre for Public History, which really suited me, Craig, because public history was becoming increasingly a preoccupation of mine. Yep. I've been doing lots of radio, but I also got this whiz-bang kind of gig as a history presenter on the History Channel, working with Mike Munro and a few other people. And our job was to open the cold cases of bushrangers. So we looked at four different bushranger stories to try and work out what had actually happened in a couple of instances. So that was pretty cool, having an opportunity to learn about how
but
to do TV.
But also presenting it that way too.
Yeah, I think so. So there was a forensic scientist, there was an archaeologist, and there was myself. And, you know, it was really interesting to have us sitting around the table as in what was a pretty interdisciplinary context, but to be thinking also, okay, how do we communicate this? It's an interesting thing because, you know, as a historian, I'm obsessed with context and the kind of context that you need and want in those situations. You have to become pretty deft, as I think you know, in how you get to the point of what you're trying to say. Whereas with context, it's usually, well, there's a bit of this and a bit of that. People don't love nuance, right? But we will insist upon it nonetheless. And so, but now I have this unbelievable job. So I finished my ARC, got the book done, which we're going to talk about. And somewhere in between there, I was unbelievably lucky to be invited to take up the inaugural position of the History Advocate at the History Trust of South Australia. And in that role, my job is to champion history in all its forms, all its expressions and explorations by experts and enthusiasts, and also to be the primary spokesperson for South Australian history, which I can only do by drawing on the deep expertise of all the people who, all the history lovers across the state.
But to be able to bring together all of those people,
yeah,
must be exciting as well.
Yeah, that's it. So I've still got a foot in the academic world. I've got appointments at university, adjuncts at Flinders, but mostly I have kind of metamorphosized into a public historian and a biographer. And, you know, I call myself a speculative biographer.
Well, I want to come to that. But you also, I've seen yourself described as a creative historian as well. So what is creative history? What is speculative biography?
I know, I'm a bit, I seem to have a bit of a taste for these terms. I think I might be, you know, somebody recently accused me, and I think rightly so, of coining these terms to try and advance as much territory as possible and to be a bit provocative. And maybe there is some truth to that. But I guess what I'm trying to say is that I'm not sure that capital H history is going to stand us in good stead for what we need to be doing as a society into the future. That history might be a means to an end, and it might be it's not the beginning and the end of all things. History can take us to other places, and we ask that deeper question of how can history meet us in our moment.
Yeah.
I think that in order to stimulate co-custodians of the past to share and ensure those stories get broader circulation and a deeper understanding of their significance, we need to bring as many people on board as we can. And it's just not going to cut if it's the dry and musty crusties, you know, and then this happened and then that happened. So didactic forms of history and deep scholarly research, which I do myself, I have a lot of respect and time for, but we need to do something as well.
Yeah.
And this is where I think there's enormous opportunity to make more of the creative elements of history. You know, Anne Curtois and John Docker, they talked about history as getting its power from its doubledness.
Yeah.
That it was constantly able to reinvent itself because it drew on both art and science.
Yeah.
And we need to be doing that. I think the history wars, you know, they made historians a little bit nervous, and many have kind of retracted into the academy and to, you know, a wall of empiricism and positivism. And I think that's dangerous.
Yeah.
You know, we need to use our creative techniques. So I kind of believe that instead of history being a ravine on one side, you know, there's a ravine between history and fiction, as some people might recall Ian Clendenin saying in response to Kate Grenfell's The Secret River, that I like to think of history as an estuary where the waters of history and fiction can intermingle.
That's a lovely way of approaching it.
Yeah, and it's very fertile and fecund in that space. Things are going to grow up. There'll be more fishes in there, hopefully. It's a vibrant space that allows for different types of work, because ultimately, when I was writing about Adelaide and when I was writing about Marianne Gill, I couldn't get at what I wanted to do with their interior worlds, with the emotional truths of the stories, without combining fictional and creative techniques as much as historical research and historical techniques. I needed to bring them both together. To get to what I think is the deeper truth that, you know, fictional truths give us profound depths and insights, and so do historical truths. But when we bring them together, we just have an opportunity to create more dimensioned characters. When we create more dimensioned characters, we can recover a more complex past, and that is only going to benefit the future.
And particularly the period that you're focusing on, which is, you know, colonial Australian history, which we're living through an era through the process of decolonisation, which is a good thing, but we run the risk of, I think, for a lot of people, not understanding the nuances, going, oh, it was all bad or it was all problematic. And, you know, by actually bringing these people to life, you're enabling them to tell their own story in a dynamic way. Do you feel, I mean, I was going to ask a question about the book, The Convict's Daughter, because I absolutely loved it as well. But what actually drew you to that type of writing? Was it the fact that there was a limit on the documentary evidence that you had and you had to fill those gaps? Or did you go, I want to fill the gaps, you know, I want to actually bring her to life?
Yeah, a bit of both, to be honest. So what I had was newspaper records, and I had the colonial deposition, which was a gorgeous document with that signature on it. And that was kind of it, you know. So how would I tell her story? I mean, not that every biography needs to be a womb-to-tomb biography, as you say, but if we only tell a person from this one moment in their lives, I think it can be a missed opportunity.
Yes.
Not always, but sometimes. So I wanted to try and understand her better. So obviously to do that, I had to draw on the the convict records associated with both of her parents. Because her hotel was considered the best hotel in Sydney, her parents' hotel, there was a lot of material, advertising, et cetera, et cetera. Yes, and her father, Martin Gill, was pretty bloody-minded and slightly violent, I think. So there was some criminal materials around
there. Other reasons she was running away besides the love interest.
Yeah. Oh, no, definitely. I think she was fixing to get out of the from under her father's thumb. And I actually ended up contextualising that within the much broader remit, because while her family were Roman Catholic convicts from, you know, really poor slum parts of Dublin, the family with which she was trying to marry, the Kinchellas, John Kinchella had been the Attorney General, and they were Irish Protestants of that kind of old Protestant ascendancy traditions. They had worked through the British world in different kind of legal roles. And so, you know, I spent 9 months in Ireland doing research into that broader context to kind of ask that question of what is going on between these families from different religious class backgrounds. And I guess that talks to the kind of estuary that goes on within me, Craig, you know, that I'm really interested in being exhaustive in my research, but not exhausting in the way I then convey those communications through narrative. So it compels me on, you know, I look at something like that signature in the deposition and I'm there emotionally in that moment.
And it's that thing that often with history we'd lose in that personal connections, or it's not always necessarily to feel for somebody.
And look, there's one other thing I want to say, which has kind of become my new soapbox, if you like, which is that I've come to believe, rightly or wrongly, and I'd love to have more conversations about this, that imagination might possibly be the most important element that we have as part of our human experience. That imagination, you know, Roosevelt, the American president, said, it's imagination that takes us forward, that it allows us to imagine different futures. Einstein also said, you know, knowledge can take us so far, but imagination can take us all around the world and back again. And imagination is how we change our future. And so I just feel that history that doesn't stimulate my imagination when I'm writing it isn't worth doing for me. And history, I want imagination to be there as a kind of active alchemic ingredient when people read my work, that they're swept up in, and they're stimulated. Now, there's trust in this conversation, right? Yes, people need to trust that what I'm doing is my imaginative forays, if you like, are grounded solidly in informed imagination. And that's why I do oodles and oodles and oodles of disciplining myself around contextual studies, so that when people decide that they might go on the journey with me, they experience the plausibility of my approach. So I see narrative as a kind of laboratory where you're exploring these ideas and you can't advance. You know, this happened to me so long. Often when I was writing this new book, I'd be trying something out and the narrative would just come to an end, you know, because it wasn't right. So then I'd go back and stitch it and start all over again.
I was going to ask about the writing process, but let's talk about the new book, Wild Love. And as you've already mentioned, it's about Adelaide Ironside, so we're talking imaginative creativity, perfect subject as well. Firstly, who was Adelaide Ironside and what drew you to her? You've already talked about that broader cultural context of the Currency Lasses, but why Adelaide in particular? Who was she and why?
All right, well, well, let's get down to tacks then, shall we? This is a Sydney story and it is also a story of sister painters and it's also a story of women, not just Adelaide, but also her mother, Martha Redman, who was the daughter of a First Fleet Marine named John Redman. He eventually became the town jailer in Sydney and worked in that pretty nasty old jail down the lower end of George Street. And they lived across the road from that in a place called Redman Court, which he had built from the timbers that he had collected as part of his own timber lugging business that he ran on the side. So John Redman had married a woman called Mary George, and who was about 30 years younger than him. And she had been transported for the crime of forgery. Now, forgery is just such a fascinating crime in the early 19th century because we often have this inclination to think of convicts like my own ancestors as stealing loaves of bread, handkerchiefs, whatever. But a forger was typically It was a crime perpetrated by middle class people.
Yes, and it's premeditated too. I mean, a lot of those theft stories are, you know, as has been pointed out innumerable times, that they're crimes of starvation, crimes of economy and desperation. Yeah. But to be a forger, you're stopping to thinking about what you're doing.
Oh, yeah. You're taking your time to do it pretty well as well. So you have to have artistic skills. You have to have social skills. You have to have some canny smarts and, you know, ability to think steps ahead. And you have to have performative flair because you have to be able to pass that note.
Yeah.
So it was a really interesting crime, forgery, because the Banks of England hated it. They felt deeply threatened by it, so much so that it had a capital sentence attached to it. And some very, very famous high-profile people were executed in controversial terms. But Mary George got out here in Sydney in the early 19th century, and she found herself this John Redmond character, and off they went. Yeah. And they had a raft of children, one of whom was Martha Redmond. She married a Scottish broker, an auctioneer by the name of James Ironside, who had come out free, and they set up in Prince Street in Sydney. Mm. They had Adelaide, then they had another child, a little boy who died, and then the marriage just came to an end.
Yeah.
So they separated. I believe that Martha returned to Redmond Court with Adelaide Ironside.
Yeah.
And there, you know, we can peer inside the world of Redmond Court, where the family lived, because we have these little tantalising fragments. So the Redmond uncles, some of them worked in politics. One of them was an upholsterer and fitter and turner. But many of them ended up kind of later publishing poetry, poems about Charles Harper, you know, the currency lad poet. And so you get an insight into the family. The names of the people tell us that they loved the epic Scottish poem, The Ossian. So these were not your ill-educated, illiterate convict band. These were people who, you know, loved their literature, loved their art.
Yes.
And I like to think that the hand of the convict forger was there, you know, that Mary Redmond, Adelaide's grandma, was among the first to teach her to paint. But we also know that she was learning probably from Conrad Martens, who was a neighbour once they moved to the North Shore.
Yes.
And with many other of those kind of artists of the era, like Charles Rhodius, for example.
Yep.
So they grew up in Sydney, and then just before Adelaide turned 16, her mother, who had been married at 16, decided to move Adelaide to the North Shore. Now, I think it was probably to get Adelaide out of the marriage market, because that was when most colonial women married.
Yeah.
So off they went to the North Shore, which was then a kind of a little Scottish village in some ways. It lived under the fiefdom of Alexander Berry. But there were there was a bit of a bohemian feel to it too. And Adelaide then started painting Australian wildflowers. Now, this was something that a lot of women were starting to do in the early 1850s, after the London Exhibition, the Great Exhibition of 1851, where new paint boxes were put on display, and suddenly you could pick them up, take your brushes, and go out and do the kind of work that had not been really possible in nature. So Adelaide had been taught to draw from nature by the school that she went to. She went to a school called Miss Rennie's Day School for girls and ladies. And that's another Scottish influence that we see in the family. But she suddenly starts painting these wildflowers all around the North Shore. Now, we know, Craig, what those flowers were, because they made her quite famous, so famous that later in life, when she was in Europe, she would describe herself as the flower of Australia.
Oh, wow.
But with those flowers, a subscription pamphlet was eventually designed so that they could get people to buy a folio of the flowers to say to the publisher, yes, we'll subscribe to this beautiful folio of flowers. And on that subscription pamphlet, they list every species that she painted. So I've been able to go down into that detail of finding the actual flowers, because tragedy of all tragedies, those beautiful 40-plus watercolour illustrations of wildflowers, which were described as exquisite brush strokes, delicate feeling, have all been scattered to the winds, so we don't have them anymore. But based on the success of those flowers and her winning a silver medal at the Australian Museum exhibition in 1855 in that around the Christmas time, she was encouraged to follow her flowers to Paris, where they were going to the Paris International Exhibition. And so she and her mother left Sydney and embarked on their vision to elevate her sex, hoist the colours of the dear old country, and become the mistress of art.
It's very ambitious, isn't it?
Southern Hemisphere. It sure is. Yeah. But she went with these introductions. So she was a very close friend of Dr. John Dunmore Lang, who many might know. He was once one of the most famous figures in the 19th century, and not only in the colonies, but, you know, he was a firebrand, he was a controversialist, he was a jailbird for his, he was muddled-headed when it came to his finances, and he was appalling in the sort of things that he would say in the newspapers about people. So he was often in jail for defamation and libel. But he was a visionary, and he was the first to describe Australia as a future federation, and he was a bold Republican, and Adelaide shared his passions.
Yes, right.
Very much. So what we know from those poems which she published is that she saw her republicanism not in the kind of terms that we do now, but almost as a mystical realisation of Australia achieving its great potential as the golden and free lands. Independence was the way that Australia could become truly wild. And that's the kind of language that she uses. Mm. She kind of begs Australians to stop living lives of materialism, because this is the gold era has started happening now, and to return to their dignity and to claim their freedom for themselves. Mm. So this is the kind of woman that she was, right? She didn't hold her punches.
Yes, yes. Well, you talked earlier about sort of knowing how many of the women were thinking about politics, but she's putting it all out there. I can imagine that probably annoyed a few contemporaries.
Yeah, I don't think that she was particularly appreciated by the sporting set of Sydney, for example. She was certainly seen as something of an eccentric, but not entirely, Craig. And we know this because just a few weeks before she left, she had designed a beautiful silk hand-stitched banner, which she then gave to the voluntary troops of New South Wales. Now, this was the period of the Crimean War. Everyone was terribly anxious that the Ruskies were going to suddenly arrive on the shores of Sydney. People were building their towers and their tunnels to keep themselves safe from the Ruskies. Then she kind of tapped into this spirit and designed a flag, which I believe she had in mind designing the first Australian flag that had its own kind of distinctive expressions, because Dr. Lang had talked about this in some of his many lectures. And this flag has four of her Australian flowers in the centre of it and all this other embroidery. We know it because it was described in the newspapers, but it too is now lost. And then on a really wet, wintry day in Sydney in 1855, she stood up in the Outer Domain and stood before 500 or so members of the voluntary troops, and she gave a presentation to them before handing the banner on. And when in this banner, she said, "I, a dutiful daughter of my country, am going abroad to study, but I will return. And this is my gift to you, countrymen, that you will always remember my love for the country, etc., etc." But what's really
she's not modest.
No, she's very forward, you know, and she's 23, right?
Yes,
so
right,
imagine
right,
yourself at 23 standing before 500 plus troops in the rain making your declaration. But what is even better, I think, is that in her diary and in her records, there's this poem called The Sons of Fire. And this was the poem that she had actually written to present to the voluntary troops when she presented her banner.
Yeah.
And it is out there, Craig. Yeah. It's like, "Take the banner, sons of fire, roll on to enlist. Izzy will give you the flag," you know. So she, you know, I mean, one, she was not afraid to make an impression, which is just terrific.
Yeah.
But also, after she made that presentation and the voluntary troops were very pleased with it, in fact, so much so that Henry Halloran, a poet of the time, wrote a poem to say thank you to her, which was published in the newspapers. So she wasn't entirely on the nose yes. for being eccentric. Yes. There yeah. was, and this tells us also that there were men in the colonial era who could understand her vision, her desire, her desire to live, to be married to her art, not a man, to live a life of aspiration and to become, as she described, a true original. You know, this is kind of what she wanted to do. And she went with the backing of quite a few men, not only Dr. Lang, who she described as her patriotic father, but there were other men, Colonel Barney, Charles Nicholson. Yeah,
that probably segues quite nicely because, of course, she's contemporary with the founders of the University of Sydney, including Sir Charles Nicholson, the founder of the museum collections that are now housed in the Chow Chak Wing Museum. They overlap obviously here in Sydney, but they also overlap in Europe. What's the connections between the two of them?
Well, it's really interesting because Adelaide is a radical. You know, she's writing in the colonial newspapers in the most radical ones. She's connected with people like John Dunmore Lang, who certainly was antagonistic towards conservatives like Charles Nicholson. And yet her family, through her grandfather's connection, also have deep connections back to the conservative side of Sydney politics, to Darcy Wentworth and his son William Charles Wentworth, and so through that to other people who have interest in art and antiquities. Yeah. And so this is where I think the Charles Nicholson connection comes in. We don't really have any evidence of it before she leaves Sydney.
Yeah, right.
But once she's set up in Rome, where she had gone to become a sister painter, and yep. she was neighbours and friends and associates with many other women who had travelled from America all over Europe with the idea of having greater professional and personal freedom, this is what they'd done. They'd gone to become the first generation of professional artists on their own term. It's extraordinary,
it is,
right?
It is, yeah.
And we don't know much about this group of women in Australia because Adelaide was the first and the only for a very long time.
I mean, how much of her story was being followed by the Australian newspapers, or was she kind of forgotten about while she was away?
Dr. Lang
continued to
was very, very fond of Adelaide, and their correspondence is the most touching, if not kind of the most voluminous in the archives. So the records in the State Library of New South Wales are called correspondence mainly received. And most of these are letters from the famous people that Dr. Lang introduced her to.
Yep.
There's 14 letters from Adelaide to Dr. Lang, which are housed largely in his papers. But there are lots of letters from him as well. And Dr. Lang was always doing something to promote Adelaide's interests. In fact, he called her things like a native child of genius.
Yeah.
So much so that in the 1860s, he tried with Daniel Dennehy, another radical Republican politician of the period and someone who people think Adelaide had a romantic interest with, they both approached the South Wales Parliament to see if they could get patronage for Adelaide, which was a common practice. So in America, it was very typical for the governments to give money to their artists. And we see it in Germany and other places.
Yes,
you know,
yes,
this is an old tradition. But, yeah, as Charles Nicholson wrote in one of the letters when Dr. Lang's claim request was denied, you can't expect people in this land of kangaroos to have any interest in art. He went on to say, if you gave them all the stores of the Vatican, of the Sistine Chapel, for £500, they would say that you were robbing them. So, you know, what chance did Adelaide Ironside have? But she actually didn't want it. So Dr. Lang had done this without her request. And when she found out, she was furious. And she wrote to him and she said, I know that your intentions were well, but had you asked me, I would have said no. And she's underlined no three times, right? And then she goes to say, I do not make a claim upon my country.
Yeah.
In time, my country will make a claim upon me.
Yeah.
And so this is the kind of person that she was. And do you know who she really reminded me of as I started to spend longer and longer with her archives? She reminded me of Jane Eyre.
Yeah, right.
Jane Eyre, who describes herself to Rochester in that cracking scene, she says, you know, I'm a plain, ordinary, poor, little woman.
Yeah, yeah.
And Adelaide was described as small. She was similar. Rochester describes Jane Eyre as being fey and into the fairies and, you know, being related to the green people. And Adelaide was very mystical.
Yes,
and, you know, she ended up scrying crystal balls for people like the Brownings, which we'll get
into.
But she also, Jane Eyre, there's a couple of scenes where Rochester is admiring Jane Eyre's paintings, which she has done in the style of the ideal. And Adelaide also painted in the ideal.
Yes.
She, and this was a kind of German romantic idea of beauty is a true beauty. What we're trying to aspire to is an ideal of beauty. So this tells us also that she's quite high-minded. You know, she spoke French, Italian, German, taught herself German.
That's extraordinary, isn't it?
What I love is when you put all these kind of sources together, you get these really interesting little insights into how other people felt about her. Because it's correspondence mainly received, you have to look at how people are interacting with her. Robert Browning described her as having enthusiastic but wild ways.
John, oh, that's the perfect epitaph, though, isn't it?
Isn't it great? There's nothing, you have to be proud of that. John Ruskin, who she trained with in 1850, the most famous social reformist and political and art critic of the time, he said, you know, you have this noble but fireworky personality and I find it hard to separate the sense from the nonsense in you. And then Charles Nicholson himself, when she wrote to him and said, how dare you get involved in this campaign to, you know, get me patronage, he wrote back and said, I was very angry with you about the letter that you just sent me. And had I not already known what a wild, impulsive and often irrational person you are, I should be very angry indeed. But I love that because you know what's really going on, I think? There might be some truth in that, but I think it's really about these fellas not being used to someone pushing back.
Yes, yes, I'm sure. How do you depict Nicholson in the book? Because I know, you know, the passport of Sir Charles Nicholson that's held here in the University of Sydney Archives was one of the many, many documents you examined during the research for this book, but how does he come across in the book? Give us some spoilers.
Well, you can imagine after that quote that he didn't entirely endear me to him. But he has. There's quite a lot of letters from him to Adelaide in that archive. They're impossible to read, you know. truly a doctor, always a doctor. But the tone that you get from him in those letters kind of gave me some insights into the fact that I mean, he is a fascinating character,
he
came from, I think, pretty poor rural background, but he, you know, Dickensian style, he found that wealthy uncle and his fortunes changed forever.
And used the colony to reinvent himself.
Exactly. And then he gave back to the colony through the collection of antiquities, et cetera, et cetera. But look, and there's even a slight suggestion that there might have been some sort of, he may have harbored some romantic interest for Adelaide, because the woman he ended up marrying in the 1860s after that altercation with Adelaide was like Adelaide, an artist. She had some artistic skills. He'd asked Adelaide to help her out. So I think
Sarah knew the Pre-Raphaelites as well too. So there was that community in London as well, wasn't it?
Yeah, and the Pre-Raphaelites are certainly there in Adelaide's story through her connection with John Ruskin, although Ruskin was sort of falling out with Rossetti at this time, moving more towards Carlyle. But those things are all in the zeitgeist. And in fact, one of the big tensions in the book is that all the artistic traditions that she was surrounded by in Rome were neoclassical traditions, whereas in England you have this kind of explosion of Pre-Raphaelite ideas, entirely different in their tastes and sensibilities. And I think the reason that Ruskin felt that she'd been spoiled, although she was a beautiful drawer, was because she had spent all her time with these neoclassicists. So there's this moment towards the end of her career where he takes her under his wing. She's already dying from consumption. And one of the questions that I have is, you know, sort of what would have happened if she wasn't sick, if she had made that shift from neoclassicism to that more Pre-Raphaelite look. But, yeah, no, look, Charles Nicholson does not get off too easily in the book, I'm afraid to say, because I think he did perhaps undermine some of her ambitions. So there's a terrible moment in her life, which is recorded through the letters, when she's at the 1862 London exhibition with her works of art, and she believes she's going to get these colonial patrons who are going to buy particularly The Marriage of Cana, so it can be a gift that she will give back to her country. And there's this mystery buyer sniffing around, prepared to pay the money that it has been valued at by other high-profile art critics at the time, at £1,500. But something happens, Gray, and the deal falls through, and she writes this agonising letter to Dr. Lang where she says, I'm sitting in the halls of the great exhibition with 6,000 traipsing above and below and all around, and I have to tell you that this thing that we hoped would happen hasn't happened. And I can't help thinking that Nicholson, who didn't like her artwork, he basically said, stop drawing religious paintings and start drawing Shakespearean topics, literary topics like the Pre-Raphaelites. So I think he might have just said to the buyers when they came to the great Sir Charles Nicholson for advice about this work, he might have just looked the other way and scratched his chin and said, and that was enough to scare them off. So
the painting itself, The Marriage of Cana, did end up in Sydney. Mm-hmm. And indeed it ended up here on campus, or it's still in Sydney now, but it's now in the Archive of New South Wales's collection, but it was hung in the dining room of St. Paul's College. How did it get here?
Adelaide and her mother lived in Rome for over a decade, and they had intended to be there for as long as the Siege of Troy, they told Lang, and then they would come back so that she could paint Republican frescoes on the public buildings, on the halls of learning and the halls of debate. So she intended to paint her frescoes here on the University of Sydney campus.
She intended. Did the university know this?
Oh, details, Craig. But despite the fact that she received considerable awards and accolades, she won prizes, she was even given entree into a very elect academy in Italy, she was not able to secure colonial patronage for her work. And so when she died of tuberculosis at the age of 36 in Rome, in 1867, her mother Martha was there with all the works and, you know, a kind of what to do question. She thought that she might bury Adelaide in the non-Catholic cemetery in Rome, where Shelley and Keats had been buried. Yes. But eventually she decided that she would embalm Adelaide's remains and return to London with the idea of getting the subscriptions for the flower folio so that that could be published. She would secure Adelaide's legacy and then have the money to return Adelaide home to Sydney so she could be buried among her wildflowers.
Yeah.
They got to London and Adelaide was put in the catacombs of West London Cemetery. But unfortunately, Martha also contracted tuberculosis. And after a year or so of knocking on people's doors, trying to get the subscriptions for the folio, the publisher went bankrupt and the folio of flowers disappeared. And I think that was just so devastating for her that she quickly succumbed to tuberculosis. So the two women were buried in London together and all the objects returned to the husband of one of Martha's best friends. And Martha's best friend was Sarah Wentworth. Who rushed up to see her dear friend after she had died.
Yeah.
And so William Charles Wentworth was an executor of the Ironsides estate, and he gathered up all the objects, all the artwork.
You're listening to Object Matters. My guest for this episode is Dr. Kira Lindsay. Now, Kira, Object Matters, we've got to talk about an object somewhere along the way. So what have you chosen?
Well, I've chosen that contentious statue that sits in the Great Hall at the University of Sydney, and it's a statue of William Charles Wentworth, which was created by the Italian sculptor Tenorani in 1860.
Now, I think anyone who's graduated from the University of Sydney has spent time underneath Wentworth's watchful eyes. It's an iconic piece within the university, and again, because of its positioning within the Great Hall. What made you choose this particular piece?
Well, the Wentworth family were very close with the Redmond family, which was Martha Redmond, Adelaide's mum. It was their family. So there is evidence to confirm that Martha's grandfather, John Redmond, the first Fleet Marine and town jailer, sold some of his property to Darcy Wentworth, who was William Charles's father, and that the family seemed to have remained relatively close. Wentworth married Sarah Cox, whose father was an anchor maker. And of course, John Redmond, Martha's father, spent a lot of time on the harbour, as well as being the town jailer. He lugged timber around and lived right on Circular Quay as well. So I think the families had deep connections. And in fact, William Charles Wentworth was a co-executor for Martha and Adelaide's will, along with William Redmond, Martha's younger brother. But Adelaide had a pretty contentious relationship with William Wentworth, I think.
I wanted to ask about this. It's quite complex, isn't it, the relationship?
Yeah. So, look, I think what I've gleaned from Adelaide's complex archive is that to be a sister painter at that period of time,
in any country, let alone in the colonies, where there had never been any such thing. As a woman who was dedicated to being a professional artist in the way that she was, that you had to kind of walk through a minefield and try and keep as many patrons as you could. But Adelaide was an ardent Republican. And when Wentworth was trying to stitch together his constitutional bill that was going to kind of water down our democratic structures, and with what, in fact, Dr. Lang, and then later Dennehy called a bunyip aristocracy. Adelaide was right there getting involved in all that. And she wrote a poem about Wentworth, which was published in the People's Advocate, called To the Hater of the People. And so she really definitely had something to say about him. And yet these are old, deep family ties. Yeah. And while the Ironsides were living in Italy, the Wentworths visited regularly. So when Wentworth was there having his statue done by Tenorani, they were spending time with the Ironsides. And we know that because Adelaide sketched both of Wentworth's daughters at that time. Yeah. And there are little other traces in the archives about it. It's even possible, as some have speculated, that Adelaide may have introduced Wentworth to Tenorani, because Wentworth was very close with John Gibson, a Welsh sculptor who had lived in Rome. He was the doyen of the sculptural world in Italy at the time. So he had lived in Italy, in Rome, since the 1820s. And he was Queen Victoria's favourite sculptor. He couldn't do it, even though Wentworth approached him and asked him. So it's possible that between them, they introduced Wentworth to Tenorani. And so the composition continued thus. But what we do know is that when Martha died in London in 1869, that all their artwork, their objects, their letters were all put in the trunk that they had brought with them from Sydney and packaged up, given to Wentworth, and then Wentworth sent them back to Sydney, where they came into the care of William Redman, Martha's younger brother, and from there they were sort of determined by the family what was going to happen with the estate. And in that story, there's even more contention. A case erupts among the family of Redman versus Redman, which looks like Jarndyce versus Jarndyce in Bleak House. So this is a story that just keeps giving.
I mean, it's interesting that the family connections over multiple generations, but also I think for us in the 21st century, we're often polarized by politics, but really that fascinating, you could have very opposing political views, but actually also a social friendship, or at least a social understanding around niceties, which I think is quite interesting for us to see in the modern world, isn't it?
Yeah, look, nicely observed. And it definitely intrigued me. You know, I kind of kept saying, how did they manage this? And so that's, it's a sort of tension that I explore in Wild Love, is how she's negotiating this and also why. And I guess the fact is that if you are going to be a professional painter, you need as much patronage as you can get.
So, of course, the statue itself is iconic and very well known on the campus. It's not without its controversies, as you said in the introduction, both at the time of its unveiling, but in more recent years, which I want to talk about. Of course, there's been campaigns for colonial statues to be removed or at the very least relabeled. And a number of years ago, there was a Wentworth Must Falls campaign with a push to actually have it taken out of the Great Hall. As a professional historian, I'd like your opinion on that controversy about statues, but more broadly, how do you think Australia should engage with our colonial past and the legacy?
They're rich, rich, rich questions. So I think I might go for the first and then extrapolate out from there. So in 2021, I published with Dr. Mariko Smith, who is a graduate at the University of Sydney as well, and a UN woman with Japanese heritage. She and I co-edited a special issue of the Public History Review, which was dedicated to the statue wars. And in that, we did a kind of survey response of different attitudes about precisely these issues to do with the statue wars, asking people from a whole range of different perspectives and professions associated what they thought should be done with the statue wars. So, you know, obviously this issue was very ripe at the time. We were at home with COVID, but we were watching people taking to the streets to pull down statues in the public square. Those steel and stone things which had stood mute in our public spheres had suddenly become a kind of lightning rod, which symbolised frustration, I think, and deep resentment often about the way that our colonial histories had been told. And in that survey, Craig, what I thought was really interesting in that survey account is people offered different creative responses to how we might deal with the statues. Some suggestions that came up from Special Issue were about dialogical memorialisation. So there's a classic example of this in Western Australia, where a statue that was produced in the 19th century to commemorate a group of settlers who had been speared by the blacks when they were, and I'm using that language in quotation marks, of course, that in the 1980s and 1990s, Bruce Skase, the historian, and others worked with First Nation communities to create a dialogical form of memorialisation that recognised the First Nation stories behind that. And I think adding these kind of stories around a statue can step away from, it can provide a richer way of doing history that itself then becomes a piece of history.
Because
we can see that this was how we told the story here and now we're telling the story then. But I don't think that that's the answer to everything, right? Because we'll end up with public squares that are full of statues about statues about statues and no one will be able to walk around. But there are other suggestions, sometimes as well as pulling them down, which was the case with that very famous statue in Bristol. And I was working with colleagues from the University of Bristol at the time and it was really fascinating to hear firsthand about that story. Now, that statue, which I think triggers something similar to the Wentworth statue, that statue was about a slave owner, not a pastoralist like Wentworth, but there are connections there.
There
certainly are. Yeah. Anyway, we won't go there right now, but let's just leave it at parallels. But with the statue in Bristol, people who were descendants of the slaves had been asking for that statue to be removed for over 60 years. They'd been saying, You're celebrating this person as a founding figure, as a philanthropist, etc. But we know him as someone who plied human traffic and including our ancestors. And it's very, very distressing for us to see only this version of history being told. And they had just been ignored and ignored and ignored.
So long.
And that to me is part of the answer for this question, is that what we saw with the Statue Wars debate is people demanding to be heard. And that's really the role of historians, whether they're public or academic, is listening to the voices that are often unheard. And so when they pulled that statue down, it was saying, you haven't listened to us, so we're going to take history into our own hands. And they did so in a dramatic way that obviously captured media attention. But that's not the end of that story, right? Now, what has since happened is that someone went and put a piece of artwork on the empty plinth. People thought that that was appropriation, so they pulled it down. And eventually there was this whole discussion about what to do with the fallen statue, and a museum, a cultural history museum, was found to be an interesting place to put it, tell a story about social history. So I kind of give that background to come back to the question of Wentworth and thinking about what we might do with it. Another suggestion that was made about statues is burn down or melt down or take the material of the statue and then do something new with it, which reworks history. You know, as a public historian, I feel like it's about sometimes sitting in the round of these conversations and trying to be as sensitive and thoughtful about all of them. I have my personal inclinations about this sort of stuff. You know, I have to admit there's a part of me that, like Adelaide Ironside, that is a bit of an iconoclast. But that won't do in terms of the longer stories, which is how do we represent us together? I take exception at the argument that the statues are history and we're destroying our history when we do that, because the histories are most often sort of examples of a particular type of 19th century memorialization.
Absolutely.
You know, it's not a primary, it's not a pure and impartial primary document, I guess, is where we're coming from in that. So what I would be most interested in is conversations where all the stakeholders, all the people who are invested in this, get to sit around the table for as long as it takes and all be heard carefully and thoughtfully. That turns what is a contentious or a denied contentious issue into a lively, living conversation where relationships can form and new solutions can be made. And that's where I think the future lies with dealing with these elements of the past.
So listeners, next time you're sitting in a graduation ceremony and you look at the statue, it's not just a statue of the founder of the university, which was an oversimplification to begin with, but far more complex and nuanced stories, isn't it?
Yeah, and people didn't really like Wentworth. He was a very unpopular figure in the colony at this time. And it wasn't until he died that sort of people started to like him again. You know, there was a small enclave of conservatives that liked Wentworth. So even at the time, the statue was trying to assert a particular type of historical consciousness about his contribution that was, I guess, contentious and certainly not part of a common belief.
Well, it certainly elevated him, his role within the foundation of the university above many of his peers as well. I've always felt rather unfairly, but that's a conversation for another day.
Yeah, and as is the conversation about the foundation of the University of Sydney.
Now, Kira, I always ask people to describe their relationship with the object in one word. So for the statue of Wentworth, what would that word be?
Ambivalence.
Ambivalence.
Yeah, ambivalence. You know, like Wentworth is such a fascinating character. Growly, disheveled. You know, he walked around in his corduroy suit, grumpy with everybody, kind of mumbling to himself. He described himself as kind of having a volcanic temperament. And yet, you know, you can't deny that he did make a contribution in so many different ways. He was articulate. He was committed to what he believed in. He was kind of a rabble rouser. He's not everybody's cup of tea. I wouldn't say he's mine, but I do have some affection and respect for him, I have to say. And we today look at the politics of the past through the distorted lens of our own understanding of what terms like conservatism and liberalism mean. And what they mean back then is very different. So I think if we were to sit down and have a jug of brandy or claret with Wentworth, we would find that there were many points upon which we actually agreed with Wentworth and yes, many that we didn't. So, you know, I just beg always for us to suspend our judgment and to try and go into history with as much sensitivity, nuance, gentleness, and reserving judgment for as long as possible.
Now, look, I'm going to ask for a double bite here, if you don't mind too, but having spent these last few years since the AARC grant thinking about Adelaide, how would you describe her in one word?
I don't know if I can do one word, but there's a phrase from her poem, one of her poems, a poem that she wrote called Australia, actually, 17 stanzas published in the People's Advocate over several months in 1853. And she describes Australia as a child of nature that dares not yet be wholly wild. And I think that describes her. I think this idea, you know, everyone described her as wild, but when you look at her artwork, when you look at the nature of her life, she was constantly being constrained. And I think, you know, probably by Martha's anxieties about what her daughter was going to do with her career. And so I think she was never able to be as wild as she wanted to be. And that was one of the reasons that I gave the book the title, was a kind of provocation that the wild love was not really as wild as she wanted it to be.
Where can listeners get a copy of Wild Love?
Well, I hope that there's some signed copies in the Chow Chack Wing Museum bookstore, I believe. So they can go there. And it's in all good bookstores right now, Craig, all over Christmas. I hear it's on the must-read, not best-known fictions for November with Alan and Unwin. So I saw it at the airport in Sydney my way home. And so it's out and about. So I would love people to buy a copy and read it and give it to friends for Chrissy. But most of all, to enjoy meeting these wonderful 19th century characters who made a contribution to our future, I think.
Congratulations on the book, Kira. Thank you so much. This has been an amazing chat. I've learned so much. Thank you for your time. I very much appreciate it.
Aw, thanks, Craig. And you're a really fantastic interviewer. So thank you.
Thank you. Object Matters is recorded on the grounds of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation. The Chow Chack Wing Museum wishes to pay our respect to the traditional custodians of these lands.
Subscribe to Object Matters on your favourite podcast app and connect with the Chow Chack Wing Museum on Instagram, Twitter and Facebook. You can also subscribe to our monthly e-newsletter, News Extra, via our website, sydney.edu.au/museum.